The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with the assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings and welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, I'm the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. It's also broadcast to the Wairarapa on Arrow FM, to Christchurch in the Canterbury region on Plains Media, and of course to Waikato and Hamilton on Free FM. Well, today we're joined by a guest, Dr. Christina Hood, who is an expert in climate policy. You won't need much persuading of that when you hear what she has to say. And here's a taster of what she'll be talking about. She'll be talking about electricity pricing. She'll be talking about the importance of having independent technical voices around the policy table, about the issue of time and cost relating to climate policy. What about the ETS and forestry and other aspects of investment and transport and more? I do hope you enjoy it. And just before we go on to the interview, I want to put in a big plug to encourage everybody to submit on the absolutely appalling proposed Conservation Amendment Bill. I won't go into a lot of detail. We will post three online links in the show notes, which will go two to the Forest and Bird and one to the New Zealand Parliament. Forest and Bird have a very good explainer. They also have an incredible set of detailed maps showing all the land that is at risk of being sold or swapped or granted for concessions. And the government webpage is the one where submissions can be made. So if you Google Forest and Bird, all one word, forestandbird.org.nz, and then find the Conservation Amendment Bill, and you'll also find there will be a link there to their website with all the maps. Do submit. Submissions close on the 2nd of July. They can be done online. Do it. This is a terrible, terrible piece of legislation. It's lovely to welcome Dr. Christina Hood to our Front Footing the Future series of discussions on climate policy. Christina is an internationally recognized policy expert on climate change, energy, and carbon pricing. She's currently the chief advisor at the New Zealand Climate Foundation, where she focuses on supporting NGO capabilities and holding government to integrity and climate ambition. Christina has provided analysis and advice to government, both in New Zealand and internationally, and from 2010 to 2018 worked at and ultimately led the International Energy Agency's Environment and Climate Change Unit. Christina, it's a real privilege to have you join us today. A very warm welcome to Climate Matters.
Thanks, Lindsay. It's really great to be here.
Perhaps you'd start by giving us a bit of an insight into your role at the New Zealand Climate Foundation and hopefully give us some examples of projects in that space.
Yeah, so the New Zealand Climate Foundation is recently launched. It's an effort to connect philanthropic funding with evidence-based work on how to solve the climate crisis, really. So my personal journey on this is that when I moved back from overseas in 2018, I was looking around for where are all the jobs for the independent experts who can sit at the table with government and help solve all of the gnarly policy issues that we need to solve. And I looked around in New Zealand for, you know, where are the think tanks, where are the expert NGOs, the people with the knowledge, but also the independence to be speaking, you know, for the public and for the climate. And I looked around and there weren't any. Yeah, so there's a real gap in the New Zealand system compared to what you see in other countries. Not something that I had uniquely noticed. Lots of people have noticed this about New Zealand. And we, recently ended up in a place where we had some initial funding from New Zealand philanthropists and the leadership of the mayor, marvellous Izzy Fenwick, as our chief executive, who is a real star in the space. The idea is to really step into those spaces where there is a major opportunity to reduce emissions. So it's mitigation focused, not focused on adaptation, except acknowledging where there are synergies between the two. It's not like we're ignoring adaptation, but it's not the main focus. Yes. So one example is that we're in a situation right now where there's a lot of questions around electricity market structure. And
no, are there ever?
Yeah, it comes up every few years and it's never really gone away. But it's clearly going to be a big election period issue this year. And some of the, depending on the kinds of things that you're talking about doing, that could have different climate consequences. Two sides to it. There's the obvious one, which is just the emissions from electricity, which is important, but that's actually the small fry. The big prize is actually having affordable, stable, reliable electricity that's going to underpin confidence to electrify, because it's the electrification of transport and heat that's going to give us the biggest wins. We think we can do both of those things together, that we can keep pushing emissions out of the system and be creating the secure, affordable supply. That it's actually pushing thermal out of the system is a lot of what gives you the price drops that we're looking for in the wholesale price. At the Climate Foundation, we're looking at launching a program of work in that space, and we've got a couple of jobs advertised at the moment for roles around that. There is clearly room to move, and having the climate voice at the table can make a big difference to the direction in which it unfolds.
It's so good that you're there, Christina, because I think the energy sector is one of those that's been conspicuous by its array of half-baked information that's being put out there, particularly in the climate space.
One of the things that's really obvious is that the price and reliability of electricity, the biggest single factor is supply keeping up with demand. You know, I mean, it's kind of obvious, but if you get even 1 year behind in your build, it has a huge impact on prices. And if you can bring build forward by a year, that equally has a positive impact on prices. And the question in our heads is, have we got that balance right? But yeah, I mean, you mentioned that it's an area where there's maybe a lot of capture by the internal interests in the sector. It's not unique, but it's definitely one of them. And it's an observation and part of why we're wanting to step into these spaces. We really need expert level people who can be providing credible technical input into processes.
I'd like to shift quite a way into the question of time, cost, and climate policy. Now, I've got a bit of a background in construction economics, and I know how easy it is to either overlook the time frame you need to measure costs in, or maybe in the climate space, fail to account for what is the cost of inaction. Do you have any comments to make in that area, Christina, about how we can make sure that we have an appropriate view of the way we cost climate initiatives?
Yeah, it's an absolutely huge issue, and it bundles up a bunch of different things that are going on. There's kind of a belief systems thing where some of the key decision makers are just holding onto beliefs which are shaped by old information in a way, that they are assuming that climate policy action is an extra thing that costs a whole bunch of money, and therefore that takes away money from other things that are otherwise going to be economically productive. So there are definitely segments in our political space and even in our public sector space which see climate as an additional cost that, you know, well, we should do as little of that as we can get away with, because that's how we minimise cost. But that is not what the future looks like. The future looks like a massive economic and social transition that's coming down the pipeline. This is the next industrial revolution, and that has, you can choose to ride that wave and be at the bow of it and taking advantage of it, or you can allow it to crash over the top of you and kind of smash you into the rocks. There is a massive, massive opportunity to try and shift some of the systems within government thinking towards treating a lot more of these, what you might think of as climate interventions, as actually being economic development opportunities. The OECD in its recent report was talking about, like, why on earth is New Zealand not making more of its bioeconomy? You imagine a future where we want to be essentially off most fossil fuels, setting up a system that you could just literally carry on doing forever without, you know, eroding and, you know, mining the future. And a lot of that is going to be based around our bioeconomy. How does that relate to land use? You know, how do we think about the way in which we use our land across food and bioeconomy and conservation and all of those things? Building the future economy lens on that is not taken. And you see that every day in political statements where, you know, unfortunately, we are still seeing in the political space that action is being framed as being a cost rather than something which is helping build the future.
And one of my takes on the normal way of presenting costs is that almost by default, they assume people are thinking of costs before the next balance sheet or costs before the next election, whereas in fact, those are totally inappropriate timeframes for most climate considerations, aren't they?
It was certainly a big theme in a lot of the low carbon analysis we did when I was at the International Energy Agency, that yes, it requires really substantial upfront investment, but it is not a cost, it's an upfront investment, because on an NPV basis, that investment absolutely pays off over the longer term. But if you only think about the next 3 years until the next election, all you see is the needing to find the capital to do a bunch of stuff. So thinking about your original question, you know, around the timeframes and the financing and so on, I think that there are genuine debates to be had around how to fund and finance that investment that needs to happen. You know, is it on the one hand for the benefit of future generations, and therefore debt is an appropriate tool because it's actually paying it off over time is entirely sensible? Or is it something that we are doing because of the profligate emissions of the current generation? Therefore, there's more of a case of using money today.
You might not thank me for this, but I'd like to draw you into the possible policy space we might end up with there that might get some traction on the issues that you've just been talking about, because ultimately somewhere we need a government or a party or someone to say that's the policy we need. Do you have any thoughts on the sort of policy settings that might favour, I suppose the term that comes to my mind is a patient capital approach?
Yeah, any light on that? In a slightly different way, which is I think that there are some kind of overarching policy frameworks that can help to create the space for that. So there's been a lot of talk about an energy strategy and the need for an energy strategy, for example. And I don't think that an energy strategy needs to be a specific, very policy specific, we are doing exactly this, that and the other. But it does need to run a process that actually gets buy-in to an agreed sense of direction. So if we have an agreed sense of direction for our New Zealand energy system that, for example, involves really deeply building up reliance on our domestic, amazing renewable energy resources, and that becomes just embedded as something that we all believe, then it makes it much easier to commit to the long-term investments. There's pieces in the Climate Change Response Act which could be really strongly improved to give a greater sense of long-term direction. So while we have a 2050 target in the law, there's no clarity at all around whether that actually relates to emission reductions in the energy sector or whether it is just could just be achieved by planting more trees. The government is required to publish these things called emission reduction plans, which is, you know, here's the policy set. But the emission reduction plan in the law at the moment only has to apply to the next 5 years. And that's just madness when you're talking about a long-term transition, because what you're actually wanting to do is say, what are the investments that are needed in the next 5 years that are going to put us on track for 50 years? You know, for listeners, I'm not at all arguing that, you know, spend whatever you like on climate programs, not at all. They do need to be really well costed and justified, and it to be really clear, you know, what we are getting for the investment includes future generations and not just us in the short term.
Christina, in a moment, I'd like to steer us into the ETS a little bit. But before we go there, we're a pretty energy profligate society. And I've engaged a bit with researchers who've studied things like energy return on energy invested, EROI and things. And they're not much discussed, even though the research seems to be pretty compelling. Have you been involved in that space at all, or can shed any light on it?
I definitely keep an eye on it. I think that some of the discussions in that space are a little bit outdated in terms of many of the renewable energy technologies had been, you know, 20, 10 years ago, quite early stage in the learning curve. So you have, you know, high cost, high materials input into to making things when they are just new technologies that are getting started up. And then as you get down the sort of mass manufacture supply curve, you end up in quite a different place. And so the EROIs for things like solar have improved a lot. And then the other piece of it that I think is sometimes missing in those discussions is that the amount of energy that we need to replace with renewables is actually a lot less than some people think, because in our current fossil fueled system, we actually throw away most of the energy. So in internal combustion engines, you know, you throw away 90% of the energy, right? We've got wind and solar and hydro, and there's some potential for bioenergy, but also biomaterials for the kind of building products and things, because we still need, you know, to run a society. And we have an opportunity to, in a way, playing on easy mode, show others how it could be done. I mean, there's roadmaps now to zero emission steel and zero emission cement, and those have moved faster than people thought they would. There's kind of this phenomenon of everything seems really hard until you actually start seriously working on it. And this is something that you see in the EV space as well. You know, the Chinese battery manufacturers and the absolute leaps and bounds they are making there.
I did say before I'd like to draw you into the ETS a bit.
Well, maybe I'll start with just like the 2 or 3 minutes of ETS 101. So people assume, unsurprisingly, people assume that it caps emissions. It doesn't actually do that, you know. So the ETS is a policy which says that basically all fossil fuel emitters, plus a few landfills, for each tonne that they emit, they have to surrender one permit each year. And so the fact that that comes at a cost means that there's an incentive to do something to avoid the emissions. In New Zealand, forestry is also in the ETS. So if you register land in the ETS and put trees on it, you can be awarded units for the carbon that those trees take out of the atmosphere.
Is that unusual to New Zealand having that
scheme? It's unusual, yes. There's no other system that really has forestry fully embedded. There are others that have a small entitlement, like maybe 5%, really changes the economics in that it's just cheaper to flip marginal beef and sheep land into pine forestry than it is to make emission reductions in a lot of industrial processes. And then the fourth thing that has a really big impact right now is that there's actually a lot of units that are banked from previous phases of the ETS where settings were slacker. Then if they've got a whole bunch of them in their back pocket, they can emit more and hand over more units. The government has kind of lost control of it, and that through decisions on auction volume, they can't really control emissions very tightly. Like if I were giving advice to politicians for their manifestos, I wouldn't jump to very specific solutions yet, because I do think that we need to work it through with and make sure that it works for all the sectors, that the current foresters aren't left worse off, that Indigenous forestry gets an appropriate reward, that the ETS is tightened. So what I think they should do is actually commit to principles like, we will work to improve the ETS such that it has a stable and rising price path.
Before we close off, are there any other policy areas that you'd like to talk to, or big picture issues that you think would be good to cover off?
Lindsay, there's so much we could talk about. We could talk about the future of food and land use. We can talk about the transport systems. We could talk about the frameworks in the Climate Change Response Act. We could talk about why the Paris Agreement is in. It's actually deeply in New Zealand's interests for the Paris Agreement to succeed, because we don't want to be smashed by uncontrolled climate change. You know, that's kind We want it to succeed, and if we have to make some investment in making that work, then that's investment well made. But I think there's a theme across all of those. The theme across all of those is where we started, which is that understanding that taking action on climate has value, it's not cost, right? And so there's a value, there's the kind of economic development value, but frankly, the value of just avoiding being smashed by climate change impacts. It's why we're doing it. You know, we're not doing it to make money. We're doing it to preserve a more livable climate for ourselves and our kids and our grandkids. And that is not, it's not a benefit cost kind of a situation. We're not going to say, hey kids, sorry, we couldn't make a profit out of preserving a livable climate, so tough luck. You know, that's not the right lens through which to analyse the problem. And we need to, so that all of these individual policy areas are kind of all symptoms, I think, of thinking about it through the wrong lens.
Just to finally close off, middle of last year, the International Court of Justice reached quite a telling opinion advisory to the United Nations, which I understood was, it's not exactly binding, but it's a very strong signal in the system. Are you able to comment on where that sits in, both in terms of international climate policy and also where New Zealand sits in regard to it?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly influential. It clarifies states' obligations with respect to climate change. For countries that want to align their actions with the understanding of what's legally required, it's going to have a direct impact, because they will be looking to align with that. But there are maybe other governments who take a more cynical view and say, well, okay, that's international guidance, but international law is for international processes and it doesn't affect my domestic decisions. And it's hard, it is hard to link, it is harder to link that kind of international law stuff into domestic decisions. But it still creates significant risk for New Zealand, sitting on its hands in lots of ways, through our trade agreements and other things, through reputation into the way that we interact with the world. And, you know, even, you know, other countries starting to take challenges against countries that are not moving. That's also a possibility.
I remember in a couple of ag and climate conferences ago, Rod Carr gave what was almost his valedictory speech. And he talked about, do we want to be one of the responsible nations or one of the rogue nations? And in a way that you were almost, not with those words, but framing it that way.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some criticism of, like, is the multilateral era over? You know, why are you still clinging to the Paris Agreement and so on? I guess my response to that would be, if the multilateral era really was over, which it's not, you know, nobody apart from the US really is withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. But what we are seeing evolving is clubs and groups of the willing, and, you know, you've seen Canada kind of leading an effort to bring like-minded countries together. The EU has a very, very strong kind of bubble of countries that it's choosing to trade with who have high climate credentials. The kinds of clubs that New Zealand is going to want to be part of are going to have climate action as a part of their entry requirements. Yes. So it doesn't have to be through multilateral requirements. It is just the way of the world, and we do need to get with the program.
That seems to me a very strong note on which to finish, Christina. I've got a whole lot more questions, but I'll just keep my fingers crossed you'll come back another time. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I'm really grateful to have you on the show.
That's okay, Lindsay. It was good fun.
Well, I think you're going to get sick of me saying I'm blown away by our guests, but there's another guest who just astonished me with her insights, with her ability to express things so lucidly. Thank you so much, Christina Hood. Next week, we'll have energy specialist and system analyst Nathan Surendran, and then following that will be Simon Miller, Executive Director of Pure Advantage Green Business Organization. And then the week after that, we can expect Shamabil Yaqob, the well-known financial analyst. Thank you so much for joining me for today's episode. I do hope I have your company again next week. And as always, kia kaha for the climate. As you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz, for our contact details.